南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Hello everyone, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. So glad you could be here to listen and watch, download the podcast, watch at your convenience. Hopefully you're healthy, safe, and right off the bat, congratulations for continuing your study, strengthening your practice every day, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I'm going to return to something we've talked about before. I haven't spent a lot of time on it, and maybe we'll delve into it more in the next couple of days, is Nagarjuna's 12 gates. For Nagarjuna, I want to give you another analogy. You know, this is a period in Buddhist scholarship, very focused on the perfection of wisdom teachings, the early Mahayana teachings. All of Buddhism is concerned with the mind and how we exist in samsara and how we develop within samsara with all of its attachments and signifiers and identification and attachments, and how, while we course in that reality, in this reality, with an enlightened mind, an awakened mind, a mind that sees things that transcends the samsaric identification of everything and sees everything as it truly is. My little dog's here with me again. So pardon my distractions. So 12 gates. What are the 12 gates? The 12 gates are... should have had this bookmarked. Okay. First, causal conditions. Second, with or without effect. That's effect, not affect. Third is conditions. Fourth is characteristics. Five is with or without characteristics. Six is identity or difference. Seventh is being or non-being. Eighth is nature. That would be what I talk about as kinetic energy, momentum. That's nature. Cause and effect is nine. And ten is the creator. Don't get confused. I know that's a tantalizing word, right? 11 is the three times, past, present, future, right? And 12th is production. Now, you might be able to tell just from that list, which is why I offer it first, what Nagarjuna's preoccupation is in everything that he teaches. He is focused on this transitional mind. And this, you know, is an outgrowth of perfection of wisdom. Where is the transcendence? Where is the moment? What is it that is transcended? What is it that we see with Buddha mind that we do not see or do not understand in samsaric mind? And I thought of a really simple analogy this morning. Is a window screen. I don't know. They probably look differently depending on where in the world that you live. Some places in the world don't even probably understand what I'm saying. But everybody, I think, certainly those of you who are listening to this podcast or watching this podcast, are familiar with the fabric that gets stretched onto a frame and put in a window, or maybe stretched across an opening on a patio or a back porch or a deck, where we want to keep insects from coming in, like even a net over a bed in some countries, not even a window. It's a fabric that's, if you look at it closely, is a tough fabric that's woven into open squares. So there's little holes between the squares, right? Sometimes it's charcoal colored. Sometimes it's a lighter gray. Sometimes it's white, an off-white. But a couple of things about those screens. First of all, if, for instance, a lot of mud gets splashed up on them, or dirt daubers, wasps that build their nests and so forth, they can fill in those little holes and it becomes obfuscated, right? Or if it's just dirt. And every now and again, you got to hose those screens off. You got to wash them so that you can see through them. Here's the interesting thing about screens and why I bring it up. You can sit in front of, say, a window with a screen on it, or a screen door for that matter, and you very easily, as is through your day, will look through that screen door, that window, and see clearly what's going on outside. But if all you do, just standing there in the same moment, shift the focus of your eyes to the distance of the screen itself, you perceive the screen and you see the little dots of light that are coming through it, but you don't really see what's on the other side of the screen because you're very much in your focal length preoccupied with the screen itself. So even though you're looking at the screen itself and you see light coming through the holes, what you see is the screen. And it's not until you adjust your focus that all those different colors of light resolve into solid forms that you can see what is there. Now, I'm not talking about the porch and the front yard that you see every day, because your memory will do a good job of filling in what those blobs of light are. But I think you understand my meaning, is that if you were intent on focusing on the screen and someone you don't know walked up to 5 feet from the door, you could tell movement that someone walked up, but you would immediately shift your focus away from the screen so that you could peer through it and see who'd walked up to the door. Do you see where I'm getting? Samsara is like the screen. And awakening, enlightenment, is like focusing off of the screen to peer at what is reality. Does that make sense? There's a mental shift there. Yes, you can say it's just adjusting my eyes, but you understand. Your eyes aren't independent of you. They don't do what they want. They are functioning as a light-gathering machine, with sending impressions of that light to the brain, and the brain is dealing with the forms and what they are and how to relate to them and identifying them. Your eyes don't identify them. This is why in Buddhism we talk about eye consciousness, The consciousness doesn't happen with the eye. The eye is the apparatus to get us to a point where we can be conscious of something. So the mechanism of consciousness is thingifying. Do you see? So to peer through the screen requires a refocus, an awakening, a shift from the thing, which is the screen, albeit to another thing. But to use the analogy, this shift from the screen mind to the discarding the screen information to peer through it and make our information based on what is seen through the screen, not of the screen. This is a mental shift. And this is the same kind of mental shift that Perfection of Wisdom talks about all the time. And Nagarjuna is trying to nail it down in specifics. So this is Nagarjuna's field of study, if you will, is how to break down the illusion of the solid screen that we have invented as our perceptive filter, samsara, that seems so solid to us, and rather break down that solidity so we can then focus not on what's beyond the screen, but what is it that all those little points of light represent. Ah, I changed the analogy, didn't I? See, the screen and what's outside the screen are both things. That's a samsaric game. Where Nagarjuna is focused, pun intended, is that the screen identifies, even though we don't think about it, points of light. We identify with the fabric and the holes of the screen, samsara. But there's all these points of light that aren't so much form as they are formation, potential form. Can we grasp those points of light without resorting to creating the form? So we go, now I know what that is. Identification, solidifying, right? This is a tricky little line of perception to cross. Especially dry today. So, all of these terms, these gates, if you think of them in that way, the gates are like the little holes in the screen. How do we transcend? What does it look like to transcend? What are we transcending of our samsaric reality in order to perceive the energy of formations at work without then resorting again to making a form out of it? Go, ta-da, couch. Right? What if the couch is the screen? What can we see? What can we tell about couchness that is much more to the point of reality? What is the nature of couchness? Because there's this form in front of us that we've already identified and put thousands of associations with. What is couchness? What is it that creates couchness? Yes, there's a couch there. Nothing new about that. That's samsara. It's real. But it's real in a perceived sense that's limited to thingifying. What if we could push our perception beyond the obvious structure of physical samsara to then see with a new idea, a new mind, how the formations of everything we experience in life are really a soup of energy instantiating different forms. What if we could see the creator and the created and see beyond those to just what is the foundational truth of everything, all phenomena? I know I just jumped through some terms there, right? But he brought up creator. What is a creator? And if you can identify what a creator is, what or who or how does one create? Now, if you can peer all the way into, and I've already given the game away several times, not only in this video, but in many, many videos. If you could see that everything in your environs, which itself, anyway, we'll get back to that, is just these masses of energy. Imagine, for instance, everything made of photons. It's just energy, different forms, different behaviors of energy. So everything around you suddenly becomes, with a different eye, consciousness, everything becomes a cloud of implied formations, like the couch or painting or a wall or a stool. It's just a bound up set of energies just twinkling there. We know with our samsaric mind, that's a stool, I can sit on it. But we know with our Buddha mind, that's just a formation that's constantly roiling away in its activity. We can still sit on it, but it's kind of fun. It's different because we realize we're just floating on energies. The energy that makes our butt and our feet and our back and our head is no different than the energies, albeit in slightly different states, that creates the stool. If we could see that way, then who is the creator? And what is created? Every time you ask that question, you're referring to samsara, because you and I are the creators. And if you're looking for some omniscient magical force that's creating, then the only thing you can, it's obvious, is the energy. But you, with your mind of samsara, are choosing how to experience that creation. You solidify it. You make it a thing. I make it a thing. But if I could see beyond that utilitarian view to the actual process of being, it's just forms of energy. Everything is just forms, magnitudes, states of energy. Every atom, every molecule, every particle is itself a definition of energies. But with our screen of samsara in front of us, we formulate it, all of this information, as solid. I mean, you're going to learn the same thing in chemistry class. That everything that we encounter, remember the term density? It's just more or less how compact the molecules and the assemblage of molecules and particles and atoms coexist in a certain space time. Everything is space time. We need to stop saying, how much space does this take? How much space do you need? It's space time. It's time space. Time space. Everything is time space. If we just shift the language a little bit, we're far closer to understanding what's really going on. So what's the point of all this? We can dig and dig and dig into this mind shift. And it's fascinating. We can create all sorts of word salads to satisfy ourselves that we now have a mind that understands. What's the point? Well, this is why Nagarjuna is important to the arc of Buddhist scholarship. Because the point of all of this, to really, really get it, to get your mind to stop adhering to solidity all the time, enraptured in form, and rather shift to a perception of formlessness, just moment, point, 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 breath, that, breath, that, breath, that. Everything is just constantly roiling as a process of being. If we can do that, if we can shift our minds to understand that as a perceptive level of mind, then perhaps our distinctions of everything being independent and different from everything else, unique, possessing it, mine, yours, maybe all of that ceases to have meaning. And if all of that ceases to have meaning, what are we left with? Equanimity. In simple terms, if everything ceases to be differentiated, different, this, not that, that, not this, if everything becomes equanimous, everything is just different shapes of clouds. You know, it's like we sit, we lay on the ground, we look up at the clouds and we joke with each other, that one looks like a dog, that one looks like a teddy bear. We know we're looking at clouds, right? But we can see forms. Clouds are forms. That's our samsaric tool, right? But you can look out at the sky on any given day and see clouds of innumerable types, and yet we call them clouds. They're all clouds. So it's not that hard for us to do. But if we could do that with everything in life, then what would be prejudice? What would be predilection? What would be scary? What would be friendly? What would be mine? What would be yours? If I see a dog in the clouds and you look at the same clouds and you see a teddy bear, are we arguing? No, that's a dog. We can both chuckle and go, it's clouds. We know that. This is the same thing. Stop adhering to definitions. And rather just receive, just enjoy the clouds. Cloud you, cloud me, cloud painting, cloud couch. They're just clouds of energy. That's the only thing. That word, that little wrench in your head that goes, energy. What's energy? You can see it as clouds. You can see it as the air. You can see it as time space. Of course, we both know that that's mass. But what is mass? Is a definition of states of energy. Ta-da! Always back to this point. How in the hell do you communicate that? It's something you experience. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. That is why we chant. That is why we have this wonderful cloud mandala of the teaching of the clouds, of the force, of the essential agent of life, the process, everything. Our ability to perceive that is the unique ability of samsara. Without a samsaric engine, then there is no perceiver. So therefore, nothing is perceived. This is our great opportunity, and why Nichiren speaks about the tremendous fortune of being born human or instantiated as a consciousness being. Because it is only while in this samsaric condition that we can peer and understand beyond the thingification that made us a thing, and we can look back into it and see the essential engine of all phenomena. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. So, if you want to understand that, Nagarjuna says, well, let's take this thing apart. And he starts talking about... Oh, that's interesting. Opening to this page. Well, let's do a little reading. Would you like? I know my words can get a little bogged down. Nagarjuna says, now I shall briefly explain the teachings of Mahayana. What are the benefits of explaining Mahayana? Answer, Mahayana is the profound Dharma store of the Buddhas in the 10 directions of space and the 3 periods of time. Oh my goodness, we're right back at time space. It is spoken for the people of great virtue and intelligence. Intelligence here meaning people who like to see beyond, or who can have the capacity to see beyond what's right in their face. Curiousness. Dissection. Wanting to understand. Therefore, the mind of the ascetic, Gautama in this case, was diverted from teaching the Dharma, having thought about the incomprehensibility of the Dharma by the stupid. People who couldn't care less. Just give me my coffee and my beer, leave me alone. But the sentient beings of late times are hardly virtuous and talented, although they seek and study the sutras they cannot understand. Emptiness, having been dimly perceived, utterly destroys the slow-witted. It is like a snake wrongly grasped, or magical knowledge incorrectly applied. I sympathize with these people and I want to enlighten them. To him possessing compassion, who taught the real Dharma for the destruction of all views, to him, Gautama, I humbly offer reverence. And also I want to reveal and make clear the supremely great teachings of the Tathagata. Therefore, I will briefly explain the teachings of Mahayana. Question. Mahayana teachings are too many to be counted. Even the sayings of the Buddha alone cannot be exhausted. How can you explain and expound them all? Answer. Because of this, I said at the beginning, this would be a brief explanation. Question. Why is it called Mahayana? Mahayana is the superior of the two vehicles, and hence it is called the great vehicle. This vehicle can help people reach the ideal of the Buddhas, and hence is called great. This is the vehicle which is ridden by Buddhas and great men, and hence it is called great. It can eliminate the great sufferings of sentient beings and give great benefits, and hence is called great. It is the vehicle ridden by great persons such as Bodhisattvas. Avalokitesvara, Mahatamaprata, Manjushri, and Maitreya, and hence is called great. This vehicle can exhaust the bottom of all truths, and hence is called great. Again, in the Prajna Sutra, the mind, the wisdom sutra, the Buddha himself says that the teachings of Mahayana are immeasurable and boundless. For this reason, it is called great. One of the profoundest teachings of Mahayana is called emptiness. If one can understand this doctrine, he can understand Mahayana and possess the six paramitas without hindrance. Therefore, I want only to explain emptiness. To explain emptiness and enter into its meaning, one should use the 12 gate treatise. Once again, he's giving away exactly why he is proposing 12 greats, gates. It's not because the 12 gates are the things to learn specifically. The gates are the holes in the screen. We're constantly looking at that window screen, the door screen, and we are getting little twinkles of light, and we discount that for the screen. And so the 12 gates are opening up those holes so we can peer into the true nature of life, rather than being captured by the samsaric screen of identification, distinctions, so on and so forth. Make sense? The first gate is concerned with causal conditions. It is said, things are produced from various conditions and hence have no self-nature. If they have no self-nature, how can there be such things? Self-nature is the key concept Nagarjuna wants to refute. He is against the ontologization of any entity or object. A similar issue is examined in the middle treatise. Emptiness here means without self-nature or without own essence. There are four conditioning causes. A cause, hetu, objects of sensation, immediately preceding condition, and of course, the predominant influence. There is no fifth. On the one hand, the product consists in its conditioning causes. On the other hand, the causes do not consist of themselves. How can a product resulting from conditioning causes not consisting of themselves be consisting of those causes? Now, here we go. This is classic Nagarjuna, right? So, how can I break that down? The production of a self-existing thing by a conditioning cause is not possible. For being produced through dependence on a cause, a self-existing thing would be something which is produced. How indeed will a self-existing thing become something which is produced? Certainly, a self-existing thing, by definition, is not produced and is independent of anything else. If there is an absence of self-existing thing, how will another existing thing come into being? Certainly, the self-existence of an other existent thing is called other existence. Further, how can a thing exist without either self-existence or other existence? If either self-existence or other existence exists, then an existing thing indeed would be proved. Okay, so what is all that saying? And remember, I prefaced you with word salad. So once you get into the rhythm of understanding the language, and remember, this is a translation of what Nagarjuna is pointing to here, is our thingification of things. So, I'm a painter, so I'm going to use painting as example. You create a painting. You make a picture. Now, it's no great leap of logic for you to understand that once you're done with the picture didn't come about because of pictureness. It didn't come about because certain atoms and molecules and processes had that picture in them and then formed this picture. No, you took paint and a brush and maybe you drew a sketch and you started to follow that sketch, but you deviated. There's this whole process that came about that created this picture for yourself, right? Or that you created. And the causes that he's talking about are you picking up the brush, sweeping the brush through the paint, the crayon or the drawing, the graphite that you use. You understand? All of these things came together to create a picture which is now extant. Although it's extant moment to moment, leaving that aside for the moment. language is so funny. What he's saying is that the picture didn't come about because that particular picture doesn't exist in and of itself in the universe. It is a constructed thing. It is produced of causes. But now he goes even deeper and he says, but those causes didn't have the thing in it either. Even take it back not to the brush and the paint, but your mental processes. And not just your mental processes about thinking about the picture, but the mental processes that are running your body. Closing your hand and fingers around the brush. Dig all the way through your birth womb energy. Is there anything anywhere in that huge line of process where this picture exists? Of course not, you say. That's a silly thing to say, Sylvain. That Sifu, you're being ridiculous. Well, the point is being made that the picture only exists as an impermanent, temporary thing, and it is not a thing in itself. We get stuck there. We're in the screen, but there's the picture. Maybe. In samsara, there's the picture, but the oils are evaporating, the acrylics are drying, going into the air. The air is eroding the painting, eroding the binders. The painting, the picture is never always there. It's only there in moments. And the causes that influence that painting, as you stand back and look at it, are ongoing. The evaporation, as I said. The decay, as I said. You're just not perceiving them because you're looking at the screen. How do we define existence? What exists? And what is process? And can we say that the process gives us, for a brief time, an impression of existence? No, now we're starting to break it down. So there are conditioning causes, the energies of formation, that create an instantiation moment to moment of an enduring form. But that enduring form isn't static. It's itself constantly changing. I think that's probably enough for today on this video. But let me know if you think, I think I understand. I think I get what you're saying. Or I need to know more about when you said this. I may need to correct myself, so let me know. But this is as far as I wanted to get in this talk today, is understanding that objective reality is actually quite subjective, and that subjugation to our will to possess. I own this picture. I made this picture. Who? I? So think about that. And maybe that way you can begin to understand Nagarjuna's scholarship here, his constant drive to try to dissect for everyone the process of their consciousness so that they have the tools by which to transcend it. Of course, we have the ultimate tool, and we can do that immediately. Thank you, Nichiren. Thank you, Shakyamuni, with your Lotus Sutra. We don't have to go through all that pain. It's helpful to know, but that occurs in an instant when we chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo to this mandala to open those gates. We open them. That's our Gohonzon. Opens every gate, not just 12. It tears the screen out of the way. So boom, we can see. Always remember, this study is to lend us insights and understanding into the immediacy, the power, the value of Myoho Renge Kyo. We study from the Lotus Sutra point of view because that is the culmination of where all of this is going. You can study the driving manual every day, all day, for a year. Won't make you a better driver. Myoho Renge Kyo puts you right in the driver's seat. All right, that's enough for today. Thank you for listening. Download the podcast if that helps you. Don't forget threefoldlotus.com. All bunch of free information for you there. The bookstore, I just did a video about that. Like, subscribe, share. Contributors in support for this school, you're amazing. Thank you so much. And I will see you in the next one. Bye for now.